Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome to Podcast Like It's 1999, the podcast where we talk about the films of 99. Back aboard the Nebuchadnezzar here in 2019. We're back for part two of our Matrix spectacular. We're back with Emily Vanderwerf, the critic at large at Vox Media. She's back for the second straight week.
Hi.
This means she never left. And we're not really sure whether or not to count this as her fifth time on the show or fourth time, but either way, she's lapping the field.
Because
nobody has gotten more than I believe two.
Not so far, I don't think.
Yeah, not so far.
Yeah.
Well, I was talking with Phil last fall, and he was like, "We got to have you back on the show. What do you want to do?" And that's the conversation that led to Bicentennial Man. And then I also was like, "I want to do The Matrix." And he was like, "Really, The Matrix? We're not sure what we're going to do about The Matrix. We got to do something really big for that." And I was like, "Well, I know what I have to do."
Thank you. We really appreciate it.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I just sort of, I kind of want to hand this off to you a little bit and talk about what this movie means to you, just in terms of it feels as though it early on sparked something. And whether you were able to really either A, understand that or know what it meant to you.
Right.
You know, and now where you're at.
Right. So I wrote a piece at Vox.com under a pseudonym, the pseudonym Emily Sandalwood.
Is it still under that name or is it?
Yeah, it's still. I think we're going to eventually bump it over to Emily Vanderwerf. And we're going to be, this was published under a different name. And originally my coming out essay had a whole section on it and like how all these dudes were like, "You missed the mark." And I was like, "You see me as a woman." but we cut that. And one of the things that it was about was about, like, I really loved The Matrix. When I saw it so many times when I was a teen, I didn't really start to figure out that I was trans until my 20s. And that was the thing where I was, like, hiding from it the whole time. But I loved The Matrix so much. And more importantly, I loved the idea of a space where you could be anyone you wanted, which was a very universal early internet thing. And like, it's one of those things where you read into it from the perspective of someone who's figured that out, like, oh, that's what was going on, in a way that we read into it the Wachowski sisters' own transness, that this is a movie about them. There's so many little moments in this movie where like, Neo says to Trinity, I was expecting a guy. And Trinity says, most guys do. And like, that's such a dang trans moment. Mm-hmm. And also like Agent Smith keeps dead naming Neo. Like he keeps calling him Mr. Anderson. And like, that's, you know, such a trans thing. And it ends with Neo saying, my name is Neo before like dramatically flying up into the sky. I don't know how much the Wachowskis knew about their own gender shit. Like Lana didn't really start coming out until the mid-2000s, around the time of the sequels. I do remember that I followed the story of Lana Wachowski coming out with great fervor, and I was not that way. I still wasn't kind of clued into anything, but like I followed that and I saw the way that people covered it and was like kind of dismayed by that.
Sure.
People covered it like as a salacious piece of tawdry gossip that like, yeah. But yeah, the whole Wachowski thing is very important to me. Obviously, it's very important to a lot of trans people, but also The Matrix as an allegory of like being able to find your true self online. Like, I say I didn't know I was trans, but I was going into like chat rooms and pretending to be a girl. And like, I liked the way that felt in a way that I didn't want to interrogate, because I was growing up in this fundamentalist Christian world.
This was in high school.
Was in high school. The early days of the internet, Yahoo chat rooms. Mm-hmm. I would frequently log in as just like a girl and be like, hey, let's talk to some boys. And like, I was fascinated by how differently they treated me. And I liked that feeling of it being treated in that fashion. And I didn't really push it any further because this is the 90s. I didn't know the word trans. Mm-hmm. Like there was a time when I was like, am I gay? And I just like, I wasn't as attracted to men. Like I just wasn't. And, you know, and I think that the best way to understand trans stuff is allegorically. Like it's really hard for a person who's cis to understand what it is to be trans in a way that like, I think fundamentally we can all understand, if you're a straight person, you can kind of understand what it is to be gay. You can be like, okay, my polarity's flipped.
Sure.
I don't understand why anyone would ever be attracted to men. They're terrible. But, but you know, I definitely understand the idea of like, I see Chris Evans and I'm like, oh, I get why someone would be attracted to Chris mm-hmm. Evans. Like, I think we all kind of get that.
But only Chris Evans.
Yeah, well, yeah. No. And the hot priest from Fleabag.
Apparently.
Jesus, my God.
Yeah.
Like an echo chamber of hot priest shit on Twitter. It's crazy. Yeah. He is very good, though.
But it's really hard if you don't spend every waking moment of your life knowing something's up with your gender. It's really hard to be like, oh, yeah. Like, and this is kind of what held me back is I just assumed for a lot of my life that we all thought about what it would be like to be a woman, and we just weren't talking about it. Like that was a thing that was in all of our brains right now, and we just weren't talking about it because we were talking about The Matrix instead. And I didn't realize that there was like language for that, that was like an identity, that was like a person. But if you're not thinking about it all the time, why would you ever consider that somebody else might be? You know, we're sort of locked into our own perception. So something like The Matrix is a symbolic way to represent that journey in a way that something like – I think things like Caitlyn Jenner, Transparent, Orange is the New Black have done a lot to increase the idea of the reality of trans people. I think something like The Matrix is better at making our lives feel like experiences instead of weird kind of storytelling fetishes in a way that a lot of these other things have.
I sort of want to unpack something you just said about the idea of like that people don't think about what it's like to be a woman, for mm-hmm, instance. Mm-hmm. I feel like, yes, we are very myopic. Yes, we are very much in our own heads. We can only be in our own heads, right? But I would argue that the reason that we are constantly watching television shows or movies or listening to music or whatever is the best we can do to live through in other people's shoes.
And I've long argued that the Wachowskis' work resonates with people beyond trans people because it's sort of about the experience of being online. Because the experience of being online is if I turn on my Twitter, I'm going to get a million different people's thoughts and like they're the straight feed of their consciousness in essence. And like that is pretty close to like watching a Wachowski movie where you feel like you're tapping into these different types of people. But I guess I would say there's a difference between wanting to better understand and wanting to
actually embody.
Feeling this intense compulsion, this intense need, this intense – compulsion is the wrong word because that makes it sound like a fetish. Like we don't really have language for it. We don't really have
– longing?
Yeah, a longing, a feeling that you are somehow put together wrong. And like could be put together right in a different way.
It does feel a little bit like what you're – to use Being John Malkovich for instance, right? Mm-hmm. That idea of – I think people would – in VR or whatever. Like the idea of physically being – like a person has arrived. I hate to – but do you know what I'm sort of getting at?
We are right.
That seems
– That's – no, we are. We right. are. This is the
– But that seems like a desire that we have to live other people's – You know what I mean? To some degree.
No. I mean, not to just know you. But no, that's not what it is. Emily's not living someone else's ride.
No. And that is kind of
– Sorry. I just want to just to be right. clear. I wasn't equating that to transgender. I meant
– No. And I, right. Yeah. No, and I don't like – but I want to make that point clear.
And that's totally fair. And I apologize.
I don't want to speak on your behalf, but there's something in your – you. So, for those who don't know, you just wrote a review of Handmaid's Tale Season 3,
mm-hmm.
which
also – This is the most me thing that I could have possibly done.
It's an incredible which
also,
piece.
And I'll just – yeah, I'll just go ahead and just say what it is and just take it from you. Also doubled as your kind of coming out mm-hmm. essay.
Yeah.
And it was amazing. And I
thank you.
Reached out to you on Twitter about it. And the I'm like emotional thinking about it because the part that really touched me the most – and why I'm so happy for you is where you said something to the effect of, if you hadn't have done this, you don't think you would have made it to 50.
Right.
And I know what you mean.
Yeah.
I know exactly where you're coming from. You know, I've recently gone through some shit myself. It's not the same shit, but basically like I've long had mental illness and finally got a diagnosis. That makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's so powerful.
It's crazy. Mm-hmm. Horrible choice of words, but it's really powerful to have someone actually call it what it is and make me feel like, okay, so these things that I've been thinking forever and ever are not just a product of a broken brain. Mm. They're a product of a particular, in my case, disorder and in your case, orientation that, now makes me feel like I can go forward with my life.
Yeah.
And so what we're experiencing are so different, but that that really emotionally affected me. That idea that I'm so happy for you that like I know you're gonna get to live your life.
That weight being lifted, I
just live your it's not even like you obviously speak this more than I can, but my particular thing it's not even like a weight. It's just like I actually see. Who I am in a way that fits in with the world and with my sense of the world. So, you know, I'll turn it over to you, but I'm so happy for you. Really.
It's a language. Like there's a reason the Matrix became this symbol for so many different things. Even though I genuinely think it speaks to Lana and Lily Wachowski's experience as trans women trying to embody themselves, struggling in a world that like didn't have language for that.
The Matrix. Catharsis of figuring that out.
The Matrix is a language for anytime your life feels false. Like right. There is a window you could reach through that's not really a window. It's just like I don't even know what you'd call it. Like the mirror in the movie that reaches out and sort of grabs you and pulls you into another
portal.
World. Yeah, it's like a portal. It's not a window. It's a portal. And to a different world. And like, to your point about experiencing the ride, I spent a long time trying not to come out, feeling like, well, you know, there are days I'd rather be a man. There are days I'd rather be a woman. That's still true. There are still – like I went to the mechanic today to get my car fixed and I'm dressed vaguely feminine. I'm dressed androgynous. I'm talking in a ridiculous voice because I'm trying to train my voice to go in a certain direction and all of that. I'm very aware of how I come across. I went to the mechanic and I was like, I wish anything. I could just be in guy clothes. I could just be like, hey – it's me. How you doing? And like, but I can't do that. I gotta be the person I am. And like, so there are still times where I'm like, I'd rather be a man in this situation. But when I started thinking of myself as a woman, when I centered myself as a woman, when I started taking pills to help me become a woman, become is such a fraught word there, but you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. That's when I was a person. And like, yes, I would love to experience being Brad Pitt for a day. That would rule. I would love to experience being the hot priest for a day. That'd be great. But I always want to come back to this body in a way I didn't before. And I think that's a thing the Matrix speaks to, that we understand on that symbolic level of like, I want to be the real person. I don't want to be the construct that society is asking me to be. And like, that's a very trans thing that I think is more universal, but also leads to things like the red pill, and where people feel like the real version of themselves is a total shitbag.
Right. I mean, I just want to also say that I wasn't trying to be reductive of the trans experience
sure
in any way
Phil.
About or suggesting that it is some sort of a ride. I was speaking more to how I feel like how people ingest art,
yeah.
how they go yeah. through it, and that idea of the way that people process it and the enjoyment that they get out of the entertainment of whatever the art is. I certainly was not suggesting that.
No.
The case with
and like,
I didn't mean to call you out. I didn't think that's what you're doing.
I didn't think you were either. Yeah. But I kind of, but you kind of were. You definitely were. But that was what you were trying to do. Yeah, I know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know me too well. That's the problem.
One of the reasons I wrote about Handmaid's Tale in my essay was like that was a thing where I was like, so I kind of think of when I was in. From like 2016 to when I actually came out in 2018 was like this kind of window where I was starting to get a further glimpse into myself. Sort of that portal we talked about, that mirror yeah. into the other world, into the what was the real, the desert of the real. and yeah, I definitely like in that space, The Handmaid's Tale just reached out and grabbed me in a way that, you know, other stuff just hadn't. But also – really what kind of kicked it off was I wrote a pilot with my wife where the protagonist was a teenage girl, and it was so easy to mm-hmm. slip into that headspace. And I'd always written female protagonists, but like writing as a teenage girl, it was like some part of my brain got stuck at 13, and like writing that gave it permission to start catching up. And like, that's a thing the internet did for a lot of trans people. You went online and you pretended to be, you know, whatever. And like suddenly it wasn't pretending. It was you were finding some more real version of yourself. And yeah, I wish I'd interrogated that a little bit more. But obviously, I grew up in a place in a time where that was very difficult.
It is amazing to, you know, I think about the internet in its sort of nascent stages
mm-hmm.
And how freeing it must have been for
oh,
a
God,
while.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It just that ability to – and I – it's funny. My experience or my history with the internet, truthfully, is I didn't have AIM until I was an assistant. You know, mm-hmm. I wasn't on Facebook until I moved here. A lot of my sort of social media, what have you, all of that happened to me after I moved here. Mm-hmm. So for me in university, when the internet's coming up, I mean, I wasn't even really downloading music. I mean, I sort of had LimeWire kind of a little bit, but all of that stuff, I just wasn't really locked into it. Which isn't to say that I shouldn't have or that there's anything wrong with the people that were, but it just feels like I kind of missed out on something is what I sort of feel like, that I didn't sort of use it to explore myself, if that makes any sense. Mm-hmm. And it's great to see that it was that for you and that it gave you that sort of ability.
Yeah. And like, you know, I really started to come to terms with being trans because of specific trans communities on especially Reddit, but other places as well. Like Reddit can also be a force for good in the world, which is weird to say, but yeah,
I love Reddit.
Yeah,
I do. I love yeah? Reddit just in general. I think it is a force for good. And I think the internet's a force for good. And I think most tech companies are forces for good. I think that it's this bottom 5% or this perversion of all mm-hmm. these things
sure.
that really mm-hmm. scare me.
And
I spend a lot of time on Reddit looking at stuff that I like.
And the problem is they're kind of the power users. You know, they're
yeah,
the people who are posting
totally.
All the stuff and doing all the comments.
Yeah,
and,
flooding the zone.
Yeah. But, I mean, some of those communities, like the trans communities on Reddit, are generally very good because they're heavily moderated and they're mm-hmm. keeping that shit out. Like it's really – it really was helpful to me to like meet folks there. But like one of the things that I think is similar about the internet and the trans experience and – The Matrix is a lot of the time being trans is feeling like your brain is more real than the rest of you. And that's really true of being on the internet sometimes. And that's really true of being in the Matrix for sure, where it's just your brain set free in this like weird playground and you can transcend the limits of space and time and all of this stuff. Like, yeah, like that's the, like a big, there is.
That's dangerous. I just say yes. That in the sense, you know what I mean? Because you're not experiencing it, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
You could crawl to, I mean, I'm not just, I mean, the internet, I think, can allow you to crawl inside your, I mean, I'm just going to, on a purely like, on my own, sort of, you know, with my hypochondria and shit like that. WebMD, no good. Mm-hmm. Like, I'll just go down a rabbit hole or get stuck on any number of rabbit holes. The internet begs that of you, which can't all, sometimes isn't healthy. I'm not saying in your,
it's really in your weird case. You say that because to resolve last week's cliffhanger, it's Phil who's the Cylon. Phil is a robot.
Cylon. Spoiler.
Yeah, no, the
internet sucks, dude.
You're right.
I know.
Fuck this shit.
I'm not saying that at all. I think right. it's a double edged sword. That's all I'm saying.
It's a great question. It's kind of a great philosophical question. If you built this machine and it feeds like 95 people for the rest of their lives by killing 5 people, is that a good machine or not? Right? Like,
right. It's the Ursula K. Le Guin story, The Ones Who Walk Away from Homelus, which is, it is a perfect society, and the reason it's perfect is because there's a small child who is tortured endlessly in a basement. And like, is that a worthy trade-off? And the story is about the people who walk away from that. And like, no, that's not good enough for me. Like, a system where one person suffers is still a terrible system. Yeah. So yeah, that's kind of the internet. But at the same time, we don't know a lot about trans identities. Like, we don't have a lot of super hard science, but it seems like it's something to do with brain structure. Like, literally, this is the most reductive way I can put it, and it is not strictly accurate, but it seems to be a way that resonates with cis people, which is literally, I have a woman's brain in a body that seemed male. And because our brains are so powerful, there's just like a lot of ways that your brain gets stuck there and like doesn't perceive the world it feels like it should be, especially once you get to puberty and beyond. Some trans people figure it out when they're little kids and like, great, good for them. Some of us don't, especially if you are attracted to, like if you feel like you're a straight man, you know, like that's a, there's a lot of stuff that society is set up to benefit if you feel like you're a straight man. So it's something to do with the brain, and the most powerful thing about this has been mental, has been like all of a sudden, like this is the thing when I say I think I could have lived as a man my whole life in the piece, but I wouldn't have made it to 50. It's because I didn't know what I was missing. And now that I have the right brain juice, the right hormones in essence, I do know what I'm missing. So if you tried to take it away from me, like I would be fucking devastated.
Yeah, I want to make one other kind of point that I don't think like was made clear.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think it was implied anyway, but I want to just make this point. You weren't implying and I wasn't implying, and it's not implied that you were going to kill yourself.
No, I was 70 pounds heavier than I am right now. I have a family history of heart disease. Like there's just all these things, these warnings.
I didn't get that implication either, but
no,
just,
I know, but I think there's a,
it's clear to me. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I think it's a stereotype.
Yes.
Right. It's an expectation.
Right.
That trans suicide rates are higher, and that's not what it was. And that's what I resonated with. Not that you were going to kill yourself. Yeah. The idea was that like you were living an unhealthy life because
I didn't care. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, and you make that clear in the article, and I totally think it was fair for you to make that clarification here, but just.
Yeah. And we made that, my editor and I went around and around and around on that to make sure it wasn't like it seemed like I was suicidal.
Right.
Right.
Cause there's a stereotype of trans people being suicidal, and there are very high suicide rates among trans people, but they tend to be among trans people who are not affirmed by their closest loved ones, their closest friends. If you are a trans 15-year-old, and you come out to your parents and they say, no, you're not, that we're not going to allow you to do that. You are like at a much higher risk for suicide than like I am, you know, someone who has come out and embraced her identity and started taking hormones and all of that stuff. You know, like it, the big difference is really, are you affirmed? Are you not affirmed? Certainly there are trans people who don't fit that binary and have horrible lives and all of that. But like, they're on the edges. If we're looking at the stereotypical case, it tends to be based around if you're affirmed by the people you love and especially by your parents, if you're, you know, a teenager or 20 something.
Yeah. I mean, so I guess I'm sort of curious as to how your – do you feel like your perception of this film has changed based on where you are
now?
Oh,
yeah. Like when I rewatched it in March, the two times I watched it to write the article and I watched it with you.
Yeah.
It was so much more like, oh yeah, this is yeah. a trans allegory. Like right. this is a, I don't even know that the Wachowskis knew they were doing it, which yeah. is what kind of why it works. Like by the time they're explicitly making movies that are trans allegories, like Cloud Atlas, which my friend, Lindsay Ellis calls the transest movie ever made. Cause it is,
yeah, yeah.
is just like how we're all one giant soul. And like,
you're friends yeah. with Lindsay Ellis?
Yeah.
I'm so jealous of you.
Oh, she's.
I watch all her shit.
She's great.
Yeah. She's such a genius.
Yeah.
Sure. Her thing on Bright's like one of my favorite things ever produced.
She's so, so smart. And like the last time I watched Cloud Atlas, I watched it with her because we're like the two people in the world who really love that yeah, movie.
But she's awesome.
I feel like Bobby Finger liked it.
Yeah, there's people who really love it, but you always have to be like, well, there's all this racist makeup. yeah. There's all this yellow face and like
– But you have to see past that obviously, but that's hard to see yeah, past.
It's hard to see past because the thing I always say about Cloud Atlas is it's the greatest movie made except for all the ways it's the worst movie ever made. Yeah. And like, yeah.
It is a movie. I remember – I have not read the book, so forgive me, but – I have a bunch of friends who really love the book, and the book is they made it sound as though it's unfilmable, for lack of a better way of putting it. And just mm-hmm. in terms of the sheer scope and size and what have you, do you not think that it might have been a better miniseries? Do you not think that if they'd had the ability to be able to do it as a Netflix 8-episode, you know, limited, that it might have given them the freedom to be able to sort of, because the movie feels, and I do enjoy the film, and I've you know, I plan on rewatching it again. It's just, you got to fight to remember all the threads and all the things that are like, it's hard to, you know,
I think it would follow. I think it would be diminished by being an 8-hour miniseries. Okay. I really do. Like if you were going to do it as a miniseries, you'd inevitably be tempted to borrow the structure of the book, which is half of this story, half of this story. And then you get to the center and you do a lengthy story. That's the Tom Hanks thing. And then you come
right,
back out.
Right.
And yeah, I just, you know, I think it needs to be a movie. I think it needs to have that sheer level of like, we're trying to keep up with this ungainly thing.
That is the experience of the viewer, which I think you're either a game or you're not, you know, and I think that with each rewatching of any of their films that I do, I find myself finding something new and exciting about it every mm-hmm. time. Mm-hmm. And it's one of the things about this film that's so exciting. You know, I think that it feels like this evolving thing. All of their movies feel like they're constantly changing and evolving as you watch them, which I think is a testament to sort of the way that they see the human experience, you know, yeah. that it's never finished and that it's always doing new things.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, they're tremendous filmmakers and this film, putting aside the technical proficiency of it, you know, and whether or not they were tapped into what they were doing. I mean, Bound is obviously about a same-sex couple.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's tapping into something.
Mm-hmm.
And they cast two androgynous leads in The Matrix that look somewhat similar to one another.
I want to say that Bound is a movie about lesbians that is obviously not made by straight men, and they seem to be straight men. And yeah. like that was, I think, what kind of threw people, because it's not.
Oh, the Wachowskis at the yeah, time seemed
yeah,
to be straight
yeah.
men.
Yeah. That's what they presented yeah. as in the public, and like they may, for all I know, their coming out journey, they may have understood themselves that way.
Mm-hmm.
And like, but it's not exploitative. It's not like it's overly tender. Sexualized. Yeah, it's mm-hmm. super like, yeah, that is a movie made by women, and like. At the time, nobody said that or thought that, you know, and I think that is why that's the kind of the central tension of those early movies of theirs, Bound, the Matrix movies, mm-hmm. even not really Speed Racer, but there is an element in there of like, you know, Speed yeah. Racer is not the movie you'd expect from.
No, I mean, when they announced that they were going to do it, I remember it was a really big deal. Mm-hmm. And I remember, I mean, I was working at UTA at the time, and mm-hmm. it was a really big deal.
Too, yeah.
Emil Hirsch getting the role in it and it just being. I mean, how could it not be, right? It's their first film after the Matrix trilogy. It was going to be huge. And I just quite flatly just didn't get it. Mm-hmm. And it does feel like a little bit of an outlier in their filmography in terms of it feels a little superficial
mm-hmm.
because it's just so like glaringly in your face as a visual thing that you really have to fight to
seizure
get past
inducing.
That. Some might say seizure inducing. That, yeah, I'm not, you know, there, it's clearly an anti-corporate message within Speed Racer, but I'm not sure what they're, if they're saying anything necessarily on a gender.
Yeah. I'm just going to keep quoting my amazing friends, amazing, trans critic, Grace, I don't know if her last name is public, so she goes by Gemma Vamara on Twitter, and everybody should follow her. She had just sort of this offhand tweet about how different the world would be if Speed Racer had been the big hit of 2008 instead of, Iron Man, which was the big hit of 2008. And like, whatever your problems with Speed Racer, many people have very good problems with that movie. I love it. I love all these fucking movies, but I have to. I got to support the team.
That's how it works, right?
Yeah, it is.
For your membership.
Speed Racer is so – it's trying to do so much within the confines of what you would not expect. And like I think Iron Man's a great movie. I love Iron Man, but it is very it establishes a template that we're really just riding into the ground. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They came out almost on top of each other too, right? They were like a week apart.
Yeah, I think Speed Racer's a week or 2 weeks later and Iron Man's still riding high. And then, of course, Dark Knight comes out that summer.
Yeah.
It just sort of cements that superheroes are here forever.
Yeah, I just don't think anyone saw Iron Man coming.
I totally agree.
They just did not think that thing was going to hit on the level that it did. I think they thought it was going to be big, but it flattened everything in its path for like 3-4 weeks. It's just interesting.
Well, we talked about this in the last movie. In the last one, the first part with kind of Inception and Matrix, and we skip to the Avengers.
Yes.
Iron Man is another one that is, you know, Iron Man, I guess, sci-fi, fantasy, whatever you want to call it, where I do think
– broke the mold in its own way.
I don't remember the marketing campaign for that at all. All I remember is this is a B-team superhero, and why do I even care? And lo and behold, I was there on week one.
Same.
And I loved it. I think that's I was shocked how good it was, and I pretty much hated every non-Batman superhero movie ever made before that. Batman. I mean, Iron Man.
I think it came out of nowhere. It did come out of nowhere.
I don't think it's as influential as Avengers, because Avengers is like the movie where everybody's like, oh, you can do a universe, and Iron Man, like people when they try to replicate it fall on their face. Green Lantern fell on its face. That is it. Obvious attempt to redo Iron Man. Shazam was a pretty good movie that is trying to replicate that Iron Man thing, but also like didn't make a lot of money. You know, it was kind of a disappointment in terms of.
Well, not that this is an episode about Iron Man, but there are some X factors there, and I think the biggest one is the Robert Downey Jr. of it all. I don't think that that anyone expected. I mean, I've loved Robert Downey Jr. for most of his career.
Yeah.
So I wasn't necessarily surprised that he was great in it, but I don't think that anyone thought that it was going to be what it turned into. And that sort of.
Are there any RDJ movies in 99?
Probably.
Or maybe this was his year of exile.
This is the year he's making Ally McBeal.
Ally McBeal, I believe, premiered in 99.
He's on Ally McBeal later.
But he's in Wonder Boys the next year, and I feel like Wonder Boys was like kind of that first Welcome Back movie.
Yeah.
He's in Bowfinger.
Oh.
And he's in Dreams.
How exciting.
Well, one of them is.
What was I going to say about that
movie? Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, no problem. The to me, secret sauce from Iron Man, maybe this is just me, but my favorite moment from any superhero movie ever was him saying, I am Iron Man.
I remember you saying that to me when it came out. I remember we talked about it, and you were just like, I can't fucking believe he just says he's Iron Man at the end.
It is revolutionary.
That's great.
And the thing about the Marvel Universe that I love is most of these people do not have secret identities.
Yeah.
That's true.
And
– well, because that was DC's thing, so they were just like
– no, it was them too. You know, Peter Parker's a
– that's true. That's true. You're right.
You know,
you're
secret right. identity. And I don't know if this is true in the Iron Man comics. I mean, I know now they refer to him as Tony Stark all the time.
Yes.
I don't know if before then they did. I don't even know if there were Iron Man comics of any renown before 2008. Like, I don't know if anyone even acknowledged his character existed before 2008. You know, or even the Avengers.
It's not a name I certainly knew.
They were D-team. They were even within the Marvel Universe, they were D-team. You have the Spider-Man team, you have the Fantastic Four crew, you have X-Men, and then these losers who include a Norse god.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
But him coming out and saying, I am Iron Man, was revolutionary. It was another way to do a superhero movie.
I mean, the movie is – yeah. I think that it established a template. It kind of borrowed a little bit from Batman Begins, but in just in terms of some structural choices that were made. But I do think that it's – I do think that it definitely changed the game.
You guys forgot one
Robert
Downey Jr. movie from 1999, which is Black and White. The James Toback.
Right.
So excited.
A group of white high school teens become involved with Harlem's black hip hop crowd. That's probably aged really well.
Yeah. I'm like literally
adapting that show right now.
I'm very so, I mean, I don't know who we're gonna get to come on for that is the one, most, but it's
that was so sad about that. It's like I have somehow worked myself into a position where everything I get like brought is that show?
It's black and white, but a TV show.
I'm telling you, like, someone's going to be like, hey, we're trying to do black and white, the TV show, because that guy was an Entourage. And it's just like, ugh. Like,
I'm excited to talk about the movie, though. I'm actually curious. I watched the trailer for it.
Wasn't Toback was like the second guy Me Too'd, right?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. He's dead now.
He doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's been sent to the Phantom Zone.
I can't wait to do that movie because I think it's really kind of funny that there was a moment in time where that was considered really like kind of cutting edge.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's surreal to me.
That whole thing about, oh, wow, what if white people met black people?
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
It's crazy that was ever like a pitch.
Yeah, the 90s is like this height of like, oh, wow, white people and black people, they're so different. What if they had to meet each other?
Oh, but I mean, we were talking – now we're getting real far afield. But we'll
get back to them.
We're talking about the music of 99 a little last night, Phil and I, and like the Billboard charts. And it kind of occurred to me that, first of all, the popular music of 99 is some of the worst music that's ever been produced. It basically falls into two buckets. It's basically two buckets. It's pop stuff. Mm-hmm. So that's basically boy band stuff and Christina and Britney and Mandy Moore and then rap rock. And like, so Korn. And then there's some like also like really bad rock, like Smash Mouth. And so much
Are you calling All Star a bad song?
Yes.
You did on the Mystery Men episode.
We already have.
Doing it again.
There is only.
Going back for seconds.
And Lou Bega and novelty stuff.
But Lou Bega says trumpet. Trumpet.
What did he do the last song of?
I mean, who does that? No one else does that.
What did he do the closing credit song of? We just Stuart Little. Oh, this. He does like Mambo. He does like Mambo number 6 for the closing credits of Stuart Little. But all of these
oh my God.
Big hits, and Cher, Believe was the biggest hit of the year, so forget about that one for a second. But all of these big hits were basically just white people doing really, really bad versions of black people music.
Sure.
Rap rock is like, we're going to take rap and rock it up. And like, boy bands are just like bad versions of the Jackson 5 and Motown and R&B stuff. And then you have Christina Aguilera essentially doing like, you know, Whitney Houston songs. And it was this weird period where white people like were aware that black people existed, knew what they were putting out there in the world, and just taking it, just running with it.
I think that all of American culture, political, pop, etc., was set back by roughly the time when the WB existed.
Mm-hmm.
Just like this is an era of white people being aware that people of color exist and just being like, but we're going to just kind of appropriate some of their stuff.
Oh,
and like, we're always the center of the story. And I don't know why, but the WB just always flashes to me as like this example of like ultra white. Like,
yeah, they weren't a particularly diverse.
Great shows, though.
Great shows.
Great shows.
What, WB?
Not tremendously diverse.
But they had their period where they were the repository of black shows, right?
But they ran at the same time as UPN. And like UPN became so much more.
Yeah, so Fox was kind of built on it. And then when Fox got big, they're like, oh, we're too big now for black people. Mm-hmm. So they gave it to the WB for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And then the WB decided it was the Dawson's Creek Network and it gave it to UPN.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It was kind of weird the way that
it's
worked.
Weird.
But it did build up all those networks
mm-hmm.
because lo and behold, people like seeing different kinds of people on television.
Now, when you're about my age, Kenny, you're both about my age.
Yes.
So you had to have been super into Limp Bizkit. You had to have been.
Oh, it's so funny.
Kenny loves Nookie.
I said there were.
Did you do it all for the Nookie?
I said there were 6 songs on that Billboard mm-hmm. top 55 that mm-hmm. were good, and one of them is Faith by Limp Bizkit.
The cover?
Yes, that's one of the six good songs of 1999.
Is one of them Hit Me Baby One More Time?
Yes, Hit Me Baby One More Time. I Want It That Way, Limp Bizkit.
Fly. Oh, I Want It That Way. Great song.
Yeah, it's a banger. Slaps. I believe it was Fly Away, Lenny Kravitz, and then there were two like low down Body Moving by Beastie Boys and something else. Like these are like really, really, like I'm really stretching the definition.
99's the year of You Get What You Give by New Radicals, which I think is a really great song.
It may not have made
it. It might not have been the top 100. It was not
You Get What You Give, where at the end he's like Courtney Love and Marilyn Manson. Yeah. They're all, I don't love that part.
I don't love that part.
Oh. How do you not love All Star?
It's of course.
Objectively, it's terrible. Of course. But also objectively, it's great. Yeah. So
somebody was
blowing out.
So the Matrix.
Somebody. Stop talking about me, and I'm really upset about that. Somebody. So let's get back on topic. Right.
Do they have a good song?
Walking on the Sun. People That's a like. Bad song. They did. They did. Why Can't We Be Friends? They did. I'm a Believer.
For Shrek.
I called that the worst cover of all time.
Okay. Yes. Yeah. I don't whom? Doubt it.
Someone asked me once what the worst cover of all time was, and I said I'm a Believer. By because I think it's such Smash a great Mouth. Song. I think it's one of the greatest songs by the Monkees. So what are you gonna do?
You should get the you should get the Smash Mouth guy on to talk about the Out of Time.
Don't come on, right?
Yeah,
he tweets at everyone.
Does he?
He does.
Yeah, he just talks some shit about the Straight Pride Parade.
Well, there shouldn't be a Straight
Smash
Pride Parade.
Smash Mouth is woke.
I'm not kidding you. He really did.
Yeah, he did.
Yeah, he came at him. Good for them.
Can you believe there's a Straight Pride Parade?
Is this seriously happening?
It's happening in Boston.
Okay.
Of course, I don't know if it's, well,
I mean, that's as if Boston is like, has
I'm
a market.
Kidding. I
hate Boston. Don't get me wrong, but as if Boston, as if there aren't like,
I'm not going to go to
assholes all over the place, but I don't know if that's really going to happen. They apply for a permit. I think, oh God, I hope it doesn't happen. I actually kind of hope it does happen.
It's going to be one of those things that like fizzles out. Like, you know, they'll like have
17
the,
guys
the,
will show up.
Yeah. So like 17 guys will show up and they'll walk down the street and be like, yeah, we like chicks. I'm like, at least three of them are closeted something like, and are like sure, really keeping sure. it down. Yeah.
I don't like that it gets any air. That's one of the worst things about Twitter are that like essentially trolls get this like outsized. It's really the amplification, and I don't like that these guys get any air because really they shouldn't. It should just in you know the old days it would just be something that no one would even realize existed, and we could forget it doesn't happen. But I
remember when the Star Wars: The Force Awakens trailer came out, and there was that group of people who were really mad about there being a black person, and were like, "We're gonna boycott it." We did the work at Vox, and we traced it back to literally two Twitter accounts.
Yeah.
Two Twitter accounts started, and yes, there were a lot of people that glommed onto it, but most of the discussion was like, we condemn this.
Yes.
From two Twitter accounts. And like, there is an element to when you report on these horrible, virulent views,
you're giving them
oxygen. And like, you have to be very careful how you report on them. And one of the things that we didn't do very well in 2014 and 2015, when this seemed like this was just a pop culture story, because getting back to the red pill thing we were talking about last week, is we didn't report on them well to find a way to talk about them without like giving them oxygen. Because at the time it seemed self-evident that nobody actually
was
thought
giving
all
it credence.
This.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And then, I mean, just to kind of close the loop on that, the red pill part, that is why I think some of these men feel like the world is against them. Because I also think this is why I think Trump had kind of the rise he did, because I think I get very concerned about the reaction to this stuff. I hate giving these people oxygen. I hate the amplification of what I consider to be like just such fringy views that I think there are a lot of people who kind of otherwise would have sat probably pretty far right of center but aren't mobilizing, who feel like, don't tell us what to think.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
well, and that's
and I know, you know, believe it or not, I know a lot of white guys.
What?
Tons.
Lies.
More than you would believe. And and I sense it. Yeah. Even the vast majority of my friends are liberal. And I sense it. I sense that undercurrent of but. You know, this undercurrent of like, yeah, Trump's terrible, but, which is very frightening to me that we've moved the kind of center of the discussion, at least within our communities, that far to the left, that people who otherwise are kind of in the center are kind of identifying with the right. It scares me very much that
it's almost impossible to reason with some people now.
Well, so. this dovetails with the trans identities thing, because inevitably when I tell somebody, oh, you knew me as Todd, but I'm Emily, they're like, I got it wrong. And everybody hates being wrong. You know, like even you had no way of knowing. But when I come out to you, it feels like you got something wrong. Or when somebody's like, I really prefer they, them pronouns. It's hard sometimes to make your brain do that. And I have a lot of non-binary friends, and I still have times when I screw up and like I kick myself and I feel bad because I was wrong. And there's this very human impulse to shoot the messenger, to be like, you're telling me I'm wrong about something. And I mean, we need to be bigger than that. Like, we can't tell people they're wrong about their identities. But like, there is this like this immediate defense mechanism of like, I don't want to be wrong. I'm going to blame the person who's telling me I'm wrong, even if like most of us fight through it. There are enough people who are like, I can't get past that.
Totally.
I can't, you can't tell me I was wrong about you all this time. Not to make this about my parents, but.
But I think there's also, I mean, I think that, you know, not to, I mean, pivot back to the Matrix, but I think that that's a little bit of.
I mean, that is what we're here to talk about.
It is, but it's also like, I think that that's the frustration that people have with, but I saw the movie this way and that's the way it has to be. And that's. Short-sighted and narrow-minded, but
yeah. You know, when I published the article on Vox under my pseudonym, like a lot of the pushback from men was about the red pill section specifically,
sure.
And they were like, "I don't think this is a trans allegory. I think you're reading too much into it." And people would be like, "The two directors are trans women." And they'd be like, "They no, they weren't. They're just like doing that for cool points or something like that." But like, basically,
people said that to you?
You know, no, not to me. But this was people arguing on Facebook. You know that I did not descend into. But like, yeah, like there's definitely this element of people saw the movie one way and they took one message from it. And now you're like, well, you can read it another way. People are frequently very upset by that. Yeah. And like,
especially a movie that was this zeitgeisty, this cool.
To me, that's the core of critical thinking.
Yeah.
And like, that's kind of at the core of when we're talking about people saying a movie's problematic. And I have a lot of trouble with the word problematic. I think that it shuts down discussion. But at the same time, I think you can say like, there's a bunch of transphobic jokes in Friends. I think you can still enjoy Friends, and I think you can still, but talking about that doesn't hurt Friends. It like, it still exists. It still is a TV show you can watch on Netflix and enjoy. And like, there's gotta be a way to talk about this stuff without people going nuts.
I agree with that.
I want to ask another question. About the perception of the Matrix in society, not really today.
Okay.
That we've come kind of far on trans issues, but over the last 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'll tell you just personally, I didn't have this experience with the Matrix so much. I had this experience with Against Me. I love Against Me. They're one of my favorite bands. And when Laura Jane transitioned, it felt weird to me, even though it was obvious in her music, what she was talking about through most of their time. It felt like, wow, this band I've been repping for a long time is not what I thought it was. Mm-hmm. And it took a lot of kind of personal growth to understand that it has nothing to do with me.
Yeah.
And I liked them before and I can like them now and I love them. You know, I've always kind of loved them and never stopped listening to them, but I've only probably in the last 3 or 4 years kind of started openly identifying myself as an Against Me fan again. I mean, even just the name Against Me. But I think that there was some of that with The Matrix as well, where when specifically when Lana transitioned, I remember when Lana first kind of appeared as, after she had transitioned and she appeared for Cloud Atlas stuff.
Yep.
That was the first time I really remember.
I think it might have been – was it Speed Racer?
Cloud Atlas was her first.
Oh, was it? Okay, sorry.
The Wachowskis hate doing press.
And right, because I remember the purple.
They did a press orange hair.
Because I remember standing between Larry at the time and Tom Tickfer.
Yes.
And that being really revolutionary to me.
Yeah. Sorry.
People hadn't done that. Yeah. You really hadn't seen someone transition in the public eye that way.
I believe it was Andy, actually.
Yes, it was Andy.
I believe Lana's dead name is the one you said.
Sorry.
No, yes. But it wasn't Andy at the time.
Yeah. Yes. So that was kind of revolutionary to me at the time. But I think for a lot of people, particularly cis white straight men, probably felt a little baited and switched. Or really, I think the word I really want to use is betrayed.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's that might have happened. And I think it affected the Matrix's public standing a little bit, because I also at this time, for the last 20 years, really going back really till 3-4 years ago, transphobia was okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay in the public.
For sure.
You know, now it's like it's controversial, but it was cool up until about 5 years ago.
You talking about Laura Jane sort of made me think about when she came out. I had a trans woman friend who was transitioning that I talked to a lot at the time because I was kind of fighting through my own gender issues. And she and I had a big argument about whether you should ever use Laura Jane's previous name. I, as a journalist, was like, well, you kind of have to, because she was very prominent. And I literally don't remember what her name
was. I was just saying, I don't remember what her old name was.
Yeah. And like I, as a journalist, was like, you kind of have to. You have to be like, she goes by Laura Jane now, but she did go by this, and she used to be a man. And my trans friend was like, no, it's not like that. That experience is not like that. I am now in a position where I'm like, yeah, I don't want to hear my old name again. Like, I don't have embarrassment around it, but it doesn't feel like who I am in a way that is very like, there's a lot of violence associated with dragging it up in a way, you know, not physical violence, but emotional violence. I'm like, I get why all of these places that are reporting on me are using my old name. I get it. And there's not that many. I'm not like Caitlyn Jenner levels of whatever, but yeah. And so I'm like, I've completely done a polarity flip, and I'm a trans person. And at the time I suspected I was a trans person. So it's a lot, and it's happening so fast that like there has to be a backlash. And my hope is that the backlash is petering out. To me, as a student of society, as somebody who studies storytelling, it feels like it is, but also usually when it's petering out is when the worst happens. Yeah. So yeah.
So the plot of The Matrix.
Wow.
No, I mean.
No?
I don't know. I feel like.
I want to make one more point
about
the transness of it all, which is that in the late 90s, I've just been told this. I don't know that it's true, but in the late 90s, the red pill was, estradiol was red.
It was.
Yeah.
And that was an interesting piece that I read about how it was in fact red. I think it's Premarin tablet was the type of the medication derived in matrix-like fashion from the urine of pregnant mares.
Yep,
came in smooth, chocolatey maroon.
I actually was having a conversation about how you'd get your hormones after the apocalypse, and somebody was like, "Oh, you just find some pregnant hormones." Like this was, they said it so matter-of-factly. I was like, what?
That seems harder than you think.
No, now the primary pill is called estradiol and is blue. So now you would take the blue
pill. Now you take the blue pill. Mm. It is interesting. It's just there's a lot of either, I don't know, reductive sort of metaphors that people have pulled from the film for transgender connections. You know, there's the symbolism is relatively easy to find if you want to find it, of course, as we've said. And Thomas Anderson's double life, he's a hacker by night, his chosen name Neo, his vague but maddening sense that something is off about the world, quote unquote, a splinter in your mind. Morpheus calls it, the Matrix is gender binary, the agents are transphobia. Like there are ways of certainly unpacking it in that way, which is readily available. I think it's, you know,
hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I don't, it seems a little easy to me sometimes to think about it that way. Not that it's not there, but I think it sort of stems back to what we were talking about in terms of that this text is written in a way, this film is written in a way to be sort of interpreted the way that you want to interpret it. It does feel, you were talking sort of about how like the Matrix, the sort of scrolling text of it all feels very biblical in its own way.
I think a lot about people who make movies are often obsessed with other movies. And yeah. You could tell their influences are like, I love these other movies.
Yeah.
I kind of really push back against movies and TV shows that feel like they're assembled from other movies and TV shows.
Yeah.
And sometimes they're like Edgar Wright is a director I've never quite glommed onto because of that. His really? Movies feel put together from other movies. I think there's an element of he has a very dude-centric point of view in a weird way that I kind of like struggle with at times. Now I'm willing to admit about myself, I guess. But –
yeah, there
I don't
is
think
something...
he's a bad director. I like his movies. Yeah.
He's very – I mean I guess there is a sort of masculine but it's very beta.
Yeah.
It's a very sort of like beta male emo-y kind of – but I can see that.
My larger point is the Wachowskis, their influences are so different from the vast majority. And like a lot of them are like philosophy texts, manga, like these things that people weren't tapping into – at that time. And that's why this movie feels so original, even though there's a lot of stuff lifted from other sources.
Yeah.
But also like why you can read it so many different ways.
For sure.
And like, I think that's why it feels like it has real philosophical, rich philosophical depth to it. You know,
I think it's also sort of in the way that they've, the people they've pulled together to be in this film are also very sort of interpretive. You know, you can interpret, like, I mean, this might seem, a silly correlation, but like Bill Pope shot the pilot of Freaks and Geeks.
Yeah.
You know, Bill Pope shot Scott Pilgrim. He shot The Matrix. He shot any number of very different types of movies. Now, that's part of being a cinematographer, obviously, but it is also part of like bringing people into the fold that can't be boxed in to make sure that your film doesn't feel boxed in. I think that that's also very important. It seems important to the Wachowskis that their work across the board, but maybe specifically this film, that it not feel, too sort of hemmed in, that it can breathe and that it can grow and change.
I think that's where they get in trouble too, is sometimes they feel like, well, the human experience is universal, so we can write about anything or anybody. There are things about the human experience that are universal, but they sometimes box some. I felt that way about some of Sense8, where like they were writing about stuff that was like, you read an article about this online.
So I
that's not the right way to write.
No, that's not how you write.
That is how I write.
When you make the TV show version of Black and White, you can just like Google what are black people like.
You wouldn't
just write that.
Just Google it.
You don't want to see my search history.
Amazing. So if we start at the beginning of this film and how sort, I mean, we've talked in a roundabout way about a lot of the stuff that's in the film, but to sort of go through it chronologically anyway, I think that, you know, we talked about the opening sequence, but it's also funny too, because we talked a little bit Dark City and they use some of their sound stages. They use some of their sets and the film does start in a very noirish vibe. I mean, it's all at night. It's got these, you know, very sort of specific kind of the rain and this, it's all very, the focus on the sign, which comes full circle at the very end of the film, the heart of the city that they have, and all of that stuff feels very sort of noirish, for lack of a better way of putting it. Trinity gets to really pop in this opening sequence, and then she kind of takes a backseat to Neo a little bit as quite frankly the series progresses. And I will say that this time rewatching it, I did find myself a little bit bummed out, might be the wrong way of putting it, but at the end when she says, you know, the Oracle told me that I would love the person, the one, it's a little bit unfortunate.
Okay with it.
Okay. You can be okay with it. I don't hate on it, but it just feels a little bit like, do we need the female character to do that?
I don't think their love story feels particularly earned, which makes it like, I don't mind it. I think it pays off in interesting ways in the second and third movies, but also like, it feels like a studio note when it happens.
Like, he does love her. I don't question Neo's love for her, but it's not romantic. It's not passionate.
The idea that it's one of the all-time great loves, which the movie's really trying to sell. Yeah.
It's, I don't care. It doesn't. But maybe Kenny doesn't.
I don't know. I don't know. I mean, I had the same feeling that you did, Emily, the basic idea of we may not have gotten here.
Mm-hmm.
I think Carrie Ann Moss gets you there in that scene.
She's very good in it.
I do. I think she sells that moment really well. So
I think she also – just to give props to Carrie Ann Moss, who I do think is great in the series.
Fantastic.
Spoiler, her death in Revolutions is fantastic. She really – really sells it.
My favorite moment in the whole trilogy is actually from my least favorite movie, which is Revolutions, when she breaks up above the clouds and sees the sun and says, wow, like,
it's a beautiful moment.
No, go ahead.
It's tough when a person breaks like that, when that's kind of her breakout, because she never really had the career. I'm kind of nervous for Daisy
Ridley.
Daisy Ridley in the same way.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, it's hard when you're so associated with one particular character and one particular look.
It's true.
Because really, the only other thing I ever really remember loving her in was Jessica Jones.
Yeah, I was just going to say that's the only thing that. I mean, she's good in Memento.
Yeah, she's good.
Oh, Memento, of course, but that was in the middle of it.
Yeah. And also, I mean, I don't know how to feel about that character. She's very good in it. I don't know how to feel about any of the characters in that movie. I'm not saying it doesn't rule.
Yeah.
I'm just saying, anyway.
My former colleague Tasha Robinson calls this Trinity Syndrome, the idea of like there's this strong, super capable woman. And then she's sort of shoehorned into being the love interest for the guy. And like, I think Matrix does it better than a lot of these movies, but it became an exemplar of a trend that people.
Yeah. Well, like Wild Style and
Lego movie. That was what caused Tasha to write that. Yeah.
Well, then I may have read that piece because there were a bunch of them and it couldn't have been more stark once I read that piece.
It is interesting too, how, you know, Reloaded opens with a sequence that is sort of trying to kind of mirror like Trinity is a badass in the opening, but it's truncated in such a way because of the structure of the film that they kind of were like, oh, and then she's falling out a window. Like it never fully gels.
Mm-hmm.
And her death in that film, it's just interesting because I'm agreeing with you and also saying that it feels like Trinity just doesn't ever fully, totally get her due.
Mm-hmm.
She starts so fucking strong, and that opening is one of the best openings, I would argue, of a film ever. Like, it just opens like a bat out of hell with this unbelievable female character. And then she kind of and it leads into, you know, the next major portion of it is, you know, Neo wakes up.
Yeah.
He follows the White Rabbit. I love the White Rabbit tattoo. I've always loved that tattoo. I think it's awesome. He goes to the club. Rob Zombie blasts.
Yeah.
and she basically, and he says, you know, oh, I thought you'd be a dude. And she's like, and then she kind of doesn't do a ton after.
I don't want to keep you from discussing the plot of the Matrix film, but I do want to ask how you guys feel about Keanu as a performer. Because there's this real
resurgence
of people online, people on Twitter being like, he's a great actor.
And I think that he can be a great actor. I think that when he's in his lane or when he's in his pocket, there's no one doing what he does. I think his career is interesting. I mean, he's had a real roller coaster ride in terms of he's had several resurgences that just when people thought he was dead or his career was dead, it comes back up, you know, in a whole new way. You know, I stand by one of my favorite performances is still Parenthood.
Oh, wow.
I think that there is a lovability to him that we don't see as much. And ironically, or maybe not ironically, the most recent in Always Be My Maybe, he shows this sweetness that we don't see enough of him do because he's an action hero sort of, and that's kind of the associations that we have with him. But I would love to see him do more things like that. I'd love to see him show the softer side of him. He's wonderful in My Own Private Idaho.
Mm-hmm.
He's got some really interesting performances. He's terrible in Dracula. It's one of the most infamously worst performances. And it's interesting. I think he's great in Speed. Like, I just think there's a lot of really interesting stuff. You know what I mean? Like, he's just – I think we're lucky to have him. I think he's a really interesting performer.
Really excited to see him in this Bill and Ted 3.
Yes,
I think,
sure.
I think he's a great comedian in a weird way.
I do too.
I kind of like the Angelica Bastian argument that he's like a great physical performer, if maybe not a great line reader. And like that really comes through in movies like this, but also like the John Wick series, his latest resurgence, where like we all remember how much we love watching him move around.
Yeah. You
know, he's so – there's a dancer quality to him that's so fascinating.
Yeah. And there's also – sorry. Can I say one quick other thing? The moment he had on Colbert recently where he was asked about what happens when we die and he says, I don't know what happens, but the people that love us will miss us. Like there's just – there is something about him.
There's a Zen master quality.
There is.
Yeah.
I just – I think there he's just very human.
Keanu Reeves – all right, so I love Keanu Reeves
like
everyone else in the world, and I think when he's playing at the top, he's awesome. I love watching him, and I love Speed. I love him in Speed. He doesn't seem like a human. He doesn't sound like a human. He doesn't act like a human. It's so perfect for that movie.
So
it makes that movie run.
Yeah.
The reason I think he's more than he's bargained for is because of Something's Gotta Give.
Oh, that's right. I forgot he was in that. Yeah.
Romancing Diane Keaton.
Yeah. In real life too, apparently.
I don't know about that. Is that true?
Yeah. They had a thing apparently.
That's lovely.
Yeah.
I believe him.
Yeah.
Because there's just something about the way he played that character. Open, honest, big hearted. He was a doctor. He played an intelligent character for once in his career. And that Neo is not really so much an intelligent character. He's a magical character.
Yeah.
You know, like ultimately he's Jesus. So he's like a magical character, right? Who's kind of divinely, you know, given his powers. But I think that really kind of speaks to what you're talking about with Always Be My Maybe. Where there is another, and like he did that in those kind of cheesy movies with Sandra Bullock too, but there is another version of Keanu that, may emerge more as he gets older.
When the Jurassic World movies came out and it seemed like the next big thing was going to be randomly rebooting 90s franchises because it looked like Independence Day Resurgence was going to be huge, which thank God it wasn't. I was like, get Keanu and Sandra Bullock back at do Speed 3. I think it would kill. I think people would love it.
I think you still could. I don't think that Independence Day killed any possibility.
It would kill.
They'd have to be on a train, I think.
Isn't that unstoppable?
They could be on a plane.
That movie rules.
Unstoppable is a good movie. Yeah, no, I wasn't shitting on it.
Was that Tony Scott?
Yeah.
Those Tony Scott Denzel movies, just like boom, boom, boom. Yeah. Love them.
No, I'd love to. Speed 3, 100%. I think that, and I
$100 million
bet you,
dollar opening weekend.
I bet he comes back. Because obviously he didn't want to do Speed 2, and there's the infamous Speed 2 is not good, but
not smart either.
No, but yeah, I think that Keanu, I'm thrilled to see him getting this resurgence. I think it's great. I hope that he takes a first spin and starts taking – he took a lot of swings in his career and a lot of them didn't work because people couldn't see him in a outside of that very specific way. But I'm hoping that – first of all, he doesn't look his age. I mean, he's
spectacular. Yeah.
So I'm excited to see
that. It's because he takes swings that he's still a star because you know, I mean certainly what was it? Seven Ronin? Certainly that was a swing. But like John Wick's a swing too and that one paid off.
It's true. Yeah.
You know, there was a thing on Twitter, something to the effect that he's worked with 13, I believe, female filmmakers.
Yes.
Whereas like, I think like, what was it? Like Clooney's worked with one
or
like all the other major, not all the other major, but like
most of them,
many major male movie stars have worked with one or zero.
Yeah.
And, there's something to that too, you know?
There's also something to like the fact that there was a movie named Keanu that wasn't about Keanu Reeves. Like there's something about just the idea of Keanu Reeves that is, I think, speaks to that quality.
Really, he's mythic. There's something about him that's just amazing. He meets Trinity. Trinity tells him about Morpheus. It's an hour and 4 minutes. We'll make it. It's going to be great.
Three-parter.
Most people know the plot of the fucking Matrix, so I'm not going
to
be like, I'm not going to, you know, but I just, I do want to sort of hit some points that I do love. And one of them is the robotic bug that you were talking about.
Oh, I love that bug.
The bug's great. And
love that bug.
And the bug, the extraction of the bug is also fantastic. Mm-hmm. One of my favorite shots is the rain, bridge, him and them coming to pick him up in those beautiful old like Lincolns with the doors that open out which is just the fucking coolest.
My fantasy is a beautiful androgynous woman extracting a bug out of my belly button. That's all I want in life.
And for her to call you Copper Top.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's great stuff. And then then Neo meets Morpheus, and we have obviously the big scene, the big red pill, blue pill scene. And we will dissect this in more detail on our MTV Movie Awards episode. But the Sex and the City Matrix mashup that they do at the top of that show is real weird, and I'm not sure that it totally works.
I don't know if it works that well, but.
But there's a couple jokes in it that I liked, and one of them was, I am Morpheus, I am Carrie. I don't know. There was something about the way that Sarah Jessica Parker delivered that line that made me laugh.
She could do no wrong.
She kind of, at that
point. That's actually how I truly feel.
Like she was just kind of killing it in 99. Jimmy Fallon doesn't do a great Keanu, speaking of Keanu. So he gets sort of this red pill, blue pill thing, and he takes the pill, obviously. One of the things that I loved back in the day was the mirror sort of – they do just the perfect amount of Alice in Wonderland. Yeah. Like just enough for you to feel real smart, but at the same time also not hit you over the head with it too hard. You know, he obviously says you must feel like Alice. You do have a mirror. You do have him going through the, you know, the looking glass. All that sort of stuff. Like it's there, but it's done in such a clever way.
Well, it almost, in a weird way, it almost has to be there. Yep. You know what I mean? If you didn't, if you didn't wink at it one way or another, it would almost look as if you didn't know, like you didn't know what you were doing.
Yeah.
So it's, I agree. It's just enough.
It's just enough to be like, we recognize this influence. And you will too. So I thought that was great. Him waking up is real upsetting.
I'd make one more point about it too. The fact that it all happens within the Matrix means that the characters understand what they're doing.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
So it's not even necessarily a quote unquote Wachowski choice. Mm-hmm. It's the choice of the characters who are kind of building this world within, you know, to lure Neo. So I think that's.
And they give you just enough exposition so that you're like, okay, I think I keep up. And then you get a whole bunch you get like visuals of like the weird spider creature and stuff. And you're like, what's going on? And then there's another stretch of no exposition. And then you get more. And like, it's such a smart way to handle.
Well, and it's also just to sort of piggyback on what you're saying. There's this something crazy happens, an explanation. Oh, okay, I get it. Then something crazy that if it was too crazy, would completely throw you off the fucking thing. But it's just crazy enough that it keeps you intrigued to figure out what the fuck that means and why that's happening. I mean, I think at this point, you know, obviously he wakes up, Nebuchadnezzar, welcome to the real world. Probably the most expo-heavy portion of the film is when he goes back into the Matrix with Morpheus and he really – forgive me, downloads him on everything that's
my favorite part of the movie in a weird way.
But it also works is the thing. Like in lesser hands, in people that aren't making it visually interesting, with actors who don't know how to deliver this dialogue. I mean, this is why Lawrence Fishburne is the only person I can imagine doing this. Like it's not to say that Samuel Jackson isn't a great actor. He is, but I just don't know that him.
That's not what I want.
Yeah.
It's not what I want. I don't. There's a very subtle difference between these two guys, and it's the difference between Nick Fury and Morpheus, which is basically like Nick Fury
is a perfect way of putting it,
and Samuel Jackson is kind of like a human cartoon character, and I don't mean that in a bad way. Yeah. He works perfectly for Nick. That. I love him for that, but you know he's the guy who says get these motherfucking snakes off my motherfucking plane, and Lawrence Fishburne would never do it. Lawrence Fishburne, on the other hand, is Furious Styles, right? Lawrence Fishburne is. In every movie he's in, he's an authority figure. He is never put upon. He's never to be taken not seriously. So
even when he's playing Ike Turner, it feels vaguely Shakespearean.
Yeah.
Like he feels like he's stepped down off the stage.
Yes. Every time.
Here. Yeah.
There's not just a gravity to him. There's a humanity. There's a soul to him. I mean, I started rewatching Hannibal. Because of Blankcheck doing Manhunter. I was like, he's so fucking good as Crawford. I mean, what he brings to that performance, this sort of, there's like a depth to his eyes and this soul to him. And yet at the same time, you're like, I want to see him on top of a fucking truck on a freeway with a samurai sword. Yeah. Like it's just.
I want to make one more point, not just to compare all black actors to a black actors of a certain age to each other. But
of course,
there's also the Morgan Freeman thing,
right?
Which is the voice of God.
Right.
So that, like, Lawrence Fishburne doesn't give you the voice of God, which is super fucking important for this character. You need an authority, but he also needs to be fallible and potentially wrong for this movie to work. Mm-hmm. If Morgan Freeman was delivering that dialogue and then getting tortured, obviously Morgan Freeman's not the right guy for this movie, but that idea never would have come across. It never would have come across Samuel Jackson. Gary Oldman doesn't even like give me anything, like, you know, and that's actually like by design, I think, from him.
Well, he likes to be an enigma. Yes. That's his whole thing. But I think, and not to, you know, again, be reductive, but like Lawrence Fishburne is also incredibly cool, like in a way that this movie needed. And it's not to say that everyone else in this movie isn't cool, but
Samuel Jackson, he never fucking tells you how cool he is.
He doesn't.
You know,
he's just like, yeah, I know I'm fucking cool. Anyway, so it's at this point that we learn about, you know, they scorched the sky and humans are batteries and it's awful. The baby is one of the most haunting images, I think, in the whole film. The baby that's in the pod that's being milked for all of it's incredible stuff. There's also a subtlety to the fact that, like, even in death, we are some sort of like a power fuel system, I think, is also very interesting. And the fact that they don't really hit you over the head with it, I don't know. It's just all really, really, really well done. I think that one of the reasons that David Sims loves these movies so much is the rules. The man loves rules, and the rules are really rock solid in all of these movies. Mm-hmm. You're never confused.
That's why I really don't like the end of Reloaded.
Why?
Because you break the rules. When Smith goes into the real world,
yeah.
It's like, I thought that was really fascinating in the moment. Again, yeah. Like that, plus, that, plus the that plus the architect was like, oh, so the rules are changing. You're going to give me a new set of rules.
No, they don't really do that. I mean, it's kind of, I agree with that to a certain degree. I guess it's more back to what you were saying about how, like with Inception, they constantly feel like they need to tell you where you are.
Yeah.
In a way that that felt like studio notes. Mm-hmm. I don't need Ariadne? What's her name?
Ariadne.
Yeah, Ariadne. Constantly being like, where are we now? What level are we on? And all that sort of stuff. This movie doesn't hold your hand in the same way. It just is like, these are the rules, and this is how it's going to play out. One of them being that if you die in the Matrix, you die in real life, which I think is, you know, which obviously makes
super
sense.
Super important rule.
Super clear.
Also, I mean, I don't know if they do this. I don't think they do this. You could potentially break that rule. Like,
well, he does, sort of.
Yeah. So every rule, I mean, that's the other thing about like these rule heavy worlds. Some of these rules do exist to be broken, and you go, Neo not being able to pull the thing out of Neo's head, for instance. But yes. So
then, I love that. Then I think, honestly, one of my favorite moments in this film, and I think we talked about this after we saw it, is the ramp up when they're all going back into the Matrix for him to meet the Oracle, and the camera's spinning over them while it's spinning around the telephone, and then it cranes around and the fucking music is blaring, and they just look like the coolest fucking people in the world when they're revealed all in their like leather outfits. Every time I see it, I'm just like, this is the fucking coolest movie.
Switch's white leather is so fucking cool. It's
just
like,
I just want to live in this movie. It's just the fucking coolest. He goes and meets the Oracle. She tells him, you know, sorry, kid, you're not the one.
You skipped over the Cypher scene, which is...
No, no, it's coming.
Oh, really?
Wait, you're talking about the Cypher scene with Smith.
Yeah.
Sorry. Yes, I did skip over that scene.
I love that scene. I think it's the most human moment in these movies.
I'm
stealing that from somebody, but like literally it feels like the one scene where somebody's like super fallible in a human way. You
know? I also kind of wonder if, and it's implied a little bit, but is Cypher in love with Trinity? And this is like, he's pissed that she's...
Oh, yeah. I think it's explicit.
You think it's... Okay.
Yeah. No. Like, not, I'm not just like, I think he explicitly says something to that effect.
Well, it's in his big scene, which is coming up in a bit, when they're all unconscious and he's on the phone and he jumps on top of her and he says, he is caressing her. You're probably right. It's pretty obvious, but it's still...
But
it's
I don't think that's why he did what he did.
I don't either.
I think eating gruel every day is what he did.
I also love that you can just upload things into people's brains. Like the Matrix is just a giant wiki how. Like,
yes. It's
amazing
great.
The way they figured all of that stuff out before the real world kind of figured that stuff out, you know?
Yeah. There's also just the like, there's a lot of kind of penetration going on in this movie that the thing, when it first goes into his head, every time it still gives me the fucking willies. It's the sort of that noise and the him, he doesn't scream, but there's this high pinched squeal. It's just really, it's this sort of, it's biological and technology. It's these two things being sort of like, it's, and it's, that's in the movie sort of on mass, but I think it's great. The Oracle tells him that, or warns him that he's going to have to choose between Morpheus's life and his own. I love the Oracle scene, as I said. I think it's one of the best. I also just love her seeing what was really going to bake your noodle is if I hadn't said anything, would you have still broken the vase? It's just great stuff. And then there's the ambush and the scene with Cypher that we're talking about. What I love about it, too, is the defenselessness of our heroes trapped inside their own bodies. Mm-hmm. That idea of them all lying down and unable to fight for themselves is also a pretty amazing metaphor unto itself.
Don't want to say anything about trans identities, but
yeah, you know, this movie's not saying anything about the trans experience. And Joey Pants is just great in that scene. It's just like, he just really, I don't know. He's having a blast and he's chewing the scenery and I think he's great.
You don't love him in it? I don't love the casting.
Really?
Yeah. And I generally like him, but, and I do like, it's weird because I like him and I think he did a good job. But I also feel like everybody aboard the Nebuchadnezzar, with the exception of Tank and Dozer,
his brother,
were chosen, right? They were chosen to be.
Oh, I see what you're getting at.
Yeah, they were chosen to be kind of, what would you call it, like unplugged? Mm-hmm. And I don't know why that guy was chosen.
I used to moderate an internet forum. And when you're on an internet forum, there's always somebody who's so annoying about wanting to be a moderator that you eventually add them as a moderator. You regret that you've done it, but also they're pretty good at it, so you just let it keep going. That's how Cypher
I buy that.
He found Morpheus. He was like, I really want to be. I really want to figure out what the Matrix is. Just tell me, man. Just Joey Pants is that guy.
Yeah, no, I get it. Now I get it.
And Morpheus is just like, fuck, this is a mistake. Just
do this. He'll be less annoying here than he is on the end. Yeah.
So then they capture Morpheus. In one of the best, most disorienting shots in the movie is the shot when he blasts through the wall.
Holy shit.
And the camera is doing something that I still don't completely understand. It's an amazing moment and shot. Awful sort of the aerial shot of him being beaten up by all of the agents. And then Tank proposes they kill Morpheus. That's the only way to save Zion. To which obviously Neo says, no, this can't be a coincidence. She's blah, blah, blah. Then they go into the lobby sequence, and we have sort of this amazing shooter in the lobby sequence, which is incredible. But I have to say that it's unfortunate that it reminds me of Columbine.
It is unfortunate for you.
It is unfortunate for, yes, I agree. It isn't, but
it was only a couple weeks after, right?
It was,
Before it.
No, it was after.
After.
They were inspired by this sequence.
Oh.
That's why I can't help but think about it.
That's not actually true. The whole thing about that the Matrix caused them to do it was like a thing that...
Well, I wouldn't say that caused them to do it, but inspiration was probably the wrong way to put it.
Yeah.
They were wearing black trench coats. They were wearing...
That it made people think of the Matrix.
Right. Yes. There was some sort of a connection between these two things. Mm-hmm. Whether or not anyone... I mean, the kids were all killed. Mm-hmm. So
when was this movie released?
This was March 31st, and Columbine was April.
3 months later, or 3 weeks later.
Columbine's April 20th.
So it's just, for what it is, it's just something that unfortunately I make that correlation.
You probably would.
It's not the movie's fault.
You probably wouldn't have a shootout like this in a movie today. Like,
you didn't have it in Reloaded. I mean, Neo never shoots a gun in Reloaded, which feels like something that the Wachowskis.
That's a very conscious choice.
Consciously did. Yeah. You know, which is, and we talk about that lobby sequence. That lobby fight in Reloaded is one of the best fights in the movie, and there isn't a gun fired.
And again, you're talking about the Ebert review. Again, I think the Wachowskis agreed with a lot of his criticisms in a weird
it seems
way.
That way.
But also, I think that's where the story was progressing naturally
in these movies. Yeah. And it, you know, at first, I read stuff that said that Keanu didn't want guns, but I don't think that's because John Wick shoots a lot of guns.
Oh, yeah.
So, but you know, either way, I'm glad that they heard what transpired, you know, in terms of Columbine and whether or not it would. And I like that they made the choice. For what it's worth, I think that's interesting.
I don't.
Okay.
I think it's a good sequence. I think it's a sequence that's aged the most weirdly out what of this has? Whole movie. The Bobby shootout.
I agree.
Mm-hmm. I just, you know, I don't like giving any, again, don't like giving any air to the idea that movies cause this kind of stuff. And I'm not saying you're saying that. I'm saying that by making that change, by consciously letting like the outside world affect your art, you're letting them censor you. If they were going in that direction anyway, that's cool. But if they turned a gunfight into a knife fight or a gunfight into a kung fu fight, that feels like you are validating the point of view, which makes me very uncomfortable.
I understand that, and I'm I guess what I'm saying is that movies can be very powerful, and there are people out there, unfortunately, that don't know how to process what they're seeing sometimes. And I'm not blaming the films, and I'm not saying they should change. But I think that if the Wachowskis were able to find a happy medium that felt like they could tell the story they wanted to tell, I personally speaking, I'm not a gun person. I don't particularly.
Do you put guns in things you write?
I mean,
I'm not putting you on the spot.
No, I know you're not. Yes, I'm sure I have. But I also understand people that aren't comfortable with them. You know, we had this, you know, on Sleepy Hollow, there were a lot of people that were on some characters that were uncomfortable holding guns, and, you know, we wrote around it. So, you know, I understand both sides of
the argument. I don't mind being collaborative. That's a little different to me. Mm-hmm. But, no, I don't want anyone telling me things I can't do because of, you know, perceived societal effects of what I write.
I get that.
And every episode of Sleepy Hollow did end with Ichabod and Abby ranking their top five guns of all time.
Yeah, that's all they did.
Saw how the rankings changed.
Yeah. I mean,
this movie really is about everything, huh?
So while rescuing Morpheus, Neo gains confidence in his abilities, performs feats, blah, blah, blah. I also want to say that I don't think that – I don't want to say that there's nothing cooler, but the helicopter sequence.
Oh, yeah.
Is
rules.
Awesome.
Fucking amazing. The ripple like water of the glass of the windows when the helicopter smashes into it. Again, perfectly disorienting. Because it took me several rewatches to understand where we were when she smashes into the glass. Because you have to think about the logistics of where it all is. But it's so fucking cool that you don't care. It's just beautiful. I don't know. Like this is, and I certainly don't want to open this Pandora's box, but I'm going to open it just a crack to say, this is why I don't love Michael Bay. And because the action sequences.
Michael, what did that guy do?
The action sequences like this that feel like just a beautiful ballet, a symphony where you understand the logistics, the geography of what's going on, and it's just fucking amazing, will always trump for me a chaotic scene that's chopped up into a million fucking pieces where I'm looking at things just twisting and exploding and I can't actually tell what I'm actually seeing. And maybe it's because I'm older.
I told you 2 days ago, Michael Bay's only made one good movie.
It's true, he did.
So, I'm
really just making a stark comparison between the type of action filmmakers, the James Camerons and the Wachowskis versus, you know, your more music video-esque action directors. And it's a choice. It's a taste thing. And I understand both sides of it. But I just think there's something.
What's your favorite Bay?
The Rock.
Okay.
Yes.
What's yours?
Probably Pain and Gain.
What?
Yeah.
That's not what I expected.
I think that movie's a lot of fun.
I don't like Pain and Gain. And I'm the world's biggest Rock
fan. I think The Rock's good.
And obviously Mark Wahlberg's a close personal friend. But
I think The Rock friend of the pod. I think The Rock's good. I kind of like Armageddon, even though it's so bad.
Yeah, I like Armageddon too.
Transformers 2 is the worst movie I've ever seen in theaters. So.
Is it?
Yeah.
So I like I love The Rock. I think it's like one of the three greatest action movies ever made. And I think Bad Boys is very good. So those
Bad
are
Boys 2?
No, Bad Boys 1. Those are the two movies I like. And then Armageddon I like for sentimental reasons. I could tell that story real fast. Basically, I watched it on a plane and for the first time. And my dad was sitting in a different section of the plane. Me and my sister were in one section. My dad was like downstairs in like business and we were in coach.
Your dad got the first class? It was like
– we were flying back from South Africa. 18-hour flight. Me and my sister in coach. My dad and my mom were in business class. I love you guys. You guys are the best. My dad found me. And my sister upstairs brought us into like the galley and he's crying having watched Armageddon and saying like, this is what it's all about, kids. This is what it's all about. Giving us a hug. I'm like 15 at the time.
Maybe a little old. I was like 17. Amazing. I'm like, all right, so Armageddon plays my heart.
That's fantastic.
Outside of that, I don't think he's made a good movie.
But imagine if when Neo is swinging on the rope from the helicopter, if Don't Want to Miss a Thing kicked in.
I mean, I'm sure there's a YouTube clip of that.
Better.
It might have.
Fans of the show, please edit.
Please
that
put that together. That'd be great. So, yeah, I mean, Morpheus and Trinity exit the Matrix before Neo can. And you have, it's like a Western. There's literally like a moment where newspaper rustles by that looks like a tumbleweed. And they have a huge fight. Yeah. And, you know, then you've got your subway. Do you hear that sound? It's the sound of inevitability. And he says, my name's Neo. He jumps out. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's just the Sentinels are attacking the Nebuchadnezzar. I will say this. It's one of my bigger issues with Revolutions. I don't love the Sentinels. They just look so sci-fi channel to me.
I mean, the evil beast is, of course, sperm. You have to, like, they have to defeat
They do look like sperm.
So they
give you that.
Be yourself.
Metal sperm.
That's how it works.
Metal
That's
sperm.
That's how the Matrix works. And, yeah, okay, so then we have our Trinity scene where she whispers to Neo, you know, you can't die because I love you.
Yes.
And she brings him back to life with her kiss.
You know what? That's actually progress, because it's usually the man bringing the woman back to life with
a kiss.
That's
a good call, actually.
There's a great YouTube video about coming to appreciate the Matrix sequels that talks about the use of bringing somebody back from the dead in this series and how it becomes progressively more about some philosophical trope. And like, that is why this person learned to love them. It's like Just Right, I think is the name of the channel. Look it up. It's great.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. All right. And then Neo beats him and, you know, and then he calls them on the phone and says,
hey,
I love the way Neo
the world is. Anything is possible.
I love the way Neo beats him. I love the end.
Oh, that he goes inside him?
No, well, not that so much, but the way he just kind of calmly starts blocking all the punches.
And if you think about it, like, they couldn't have guns in the second movie because now he, like, just
Yeah.
away. Like, there's no
– That's a true. Very good point.
It stops being a story obstacle.
Yeah. I mean, he just flies
that's
real
a great
fast.
Point. Yes. And then the wake up is like, as I said to you, the most prescient thing was realizing the only rap rock group that would age well was Rage Against the Machine. Can you imagine if it was Korn at the end?
Oh, I know.
I mean, even Rob Zombie, which I love.
I actually like,
I like,
you know too much about me. I can't even remember that. That's amazing.
The Rob Zombie needle drop works for me.
I actually love that song.
It's a stupid song, but I love it and it works. But that's
Rob Zombie's not trying to be anybody except Rob Zombie.
That is true, as far as I know.
I know we need to do the end of the show, but I want to. Everything we've talked about in this has been about the idea of art influencing reality, reality influencing art. The way that this movie was taken apart in terms of gun culture, trans culture, red pill culture, all these messages this movie imparted to the larger world. And I want to talk with you guys just a little bit about the chosen one mythos that this movie deliberately plays around with. And that I think has been very kind of harmful and poisonous to our culture. Not this movie specifically, the trope as a whole.
Yeah.
The idea of the white boy from middle of nowhere, who's secretly the one who's going to save the world, that I think, you know, is so used so well in this and in Star Wars and in Harry Potter, but has become.
I mean, you can certainly see it in politics.
It's the great man theory, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Here's the thing that I do like about the one is that Neo is one rearranged. That's the only thing I like about it. But I mean, it's very Joseph Campbell. It's very sort of I don't love it because it does create sort of unrealistic expectations of people. And it shouldn't be about one person. It should be about the group. So in that regard, it's very superhero-y.
Yeah.
And again, you know, fucking comic books. But
I love the way that the sequels disassemble that idea and reassemble it into the one as a community. But I think that's also why people don't like the sequels, because it takes away your power fantasy. It says your power fantasy is a lie.
I mean, yeah. I do think, though, to go back to your Avengers thing, I think it might be why people love the Avengers so much.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think people love a good team up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they and I think there's something to that, and I wish that we saw more of that. You know, I wish we saw more groups of people, and everyone has a skill set that mm-hmm. makes them important to the puzzle of the whole thing. You don't see that very much in this series, unfortunately.
I think it's also interesting that, to spoil the sequels, Morpheus is the only one who lives. Everybody else dies.
Yeah.
And because Morpheus is John the Baptist in the little, mm-hmm. you know, we're looking at this mm-hmm. as a Christian allegory. And John the Baptist, like, the thing he does is he dies after he sees Jesus to whatever. And like, mm-hmm. that Morpheus gets to live, I think, is an interesting example of where this movie's heart is at, this series.
Yeah, it's I'm laughing because one of the things I read was that when they sat down with Val Kilmer
mm-hmm.
to play Morpheus,
mm-hmm.
he apparently talked their ear off about how Morpheus should be the lead of the movie.
Yeah.
And there's just – I mean, which is absurd. But it does – yeah, I guess I never really thought about it that way. I mean, I guess the other thing – one of the reasons why I think people were slightly or more frustrated with the sequels also was that there was this feeling of, oh, it's just one of the Neos and there'll be other ones and we just followed this, which, I mean, alternate realities and any number of other – I mean, that's part of – that's the world, right? You make choices and those choices take you down paths and maybe there's other versions of you that choose other paths and I don't know. I think that – it all really stems from the same thing, which is that the sequels didn't do what people thought the sequels were going to do. And they got frustrated by that rather than embracing them for the kind of groundbreaking thing that they were.
But putting aside the sequels.
Yes, sir. Yeah.
Because I think that that's all true and fair. I'm really just for the moment, just interested in this idea of the chosen one.
Yeah.
And the way it makes us feel as audience members, how, all right, so let's say hypothetically Neo wasn't the chosen one. I don't think that movie would have felt I think we would have felt unfulfilled if someone wasn't there for right. a chosen one.
Sure.
Right? And I think that is it's a bad way to live your life,
right.
essentially, which I've learned a lot recently. The notion of the chosen one is that someone will come and save you.
Yeah.
Right.
Right? So, Phil, you can relate to this to some extent, but when I am deep in my hypochondria hole,
yeah,
the bad part of my brain says, someone give me something.
Yeah.
Someone figure this out for me. Someone come along and save the day.
Mm-hmm.
And then what I've learned is no one will save me but myself. Like, no one will solve this problem for me because it's unsolvable. No one actually understands what goes on in my head better than I do. And only I can start to make this change for myself. So the whole chosen one idea is damaging for a society. Mm-hmm. And then what's really damaging is like every once in a while, like Barack Obama does come along, you know, and like kind of reinforces this idea
that there's, yeah,
that there are these people who can actually change the course of history for the better.
But at the same time, he didn't.
For a moment, he did. So I would
No. I love Obama. I think he's the best president of my lifetime. But at the same time, like.
Yeah, the rubber band snapped back pretty hard. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm going to. A little bit of devil's advocate and also a little bit of how I feel. But you were talking just there about, you know, when you're in the midst of a panic attack or whatever the case might be, which I have been. And I have had similar feelings to what you're talking about, which is someone help me.
Mm-hmm.
But part of it stems from a comfort in people. I'm the type of person that sleeps better when I know that there's someone around.
Me too.
So it's not necessarily that I'm looking for that person to fix me or save me, but just the comfort of knowing that there are other people around, which I think.
But those people aren't the chosen one. That's different.
No, I know. But I'm speaking to the opposite of the chosen one. The mm-hmm. idea of a group and the power of the group. Mm-hmm. So I think that in my own way, I do subscribe to that. And that's sort of how I subscribe to it. I understand how unhealthy it is to have the chosen one mentality that we have in this society. It's not great. But it's also, I understand the safety and the calmness and the idea of a group and how that, you know, how we can save ourselves if we all work together. Like, I love nothing I don't enjoy anything more on a television show, for instance. And so one of the reasons why I love The West Wing as much as I do is camaraderie. Oh, you had to
bring that up.
Sorry. I know. But camaraderie, you know what I mean? That idea of everyone working together. I love behind the scenes shit. It's one of the reasons why I love working on a television show. I love being on a set and everyone working together towards a common goal.
It's awesome.
I love sitting in a writer's room and us all trying to make the script, hopefully, the best that it can possibly be. I think that stuff is great. So I try not to let the Chosen One idea sort of bleed into me, but then I also know what it's like when you're in a writer's room and you're convinced your idea is the best idea and no one will rally behind you. So I see both sides of this. I try to sort of not be.
I think it's really interesting that this movie's sequels and the Star Wars prequels are about exploding the Chosen One myth, and people kind of fucking hate them. And like, certainly they have problems. There are problems with all of these movies, but
that's interesting.
Thematically, I think they're doing interesting things.
But I think it's interesting too, if we're going to keep running with this metaphor, that there are certain like, for instance, that the disdain that people had towards Leia, her moment in Last Jedi when she uses the Force to pull herself in, the fucking random rules, the things that people will latch on to. Now, maybe it's because she's a woman.
Boys,
maybe it's because possibly.
It's like, that's just
I mean, it's fanboys. It's bullshit. It's us giving a megaphone to people. It's them allowing, you know, Twitter allowing you to make fake accounts in order to you know, make shit sound louder and worse than it is. It's just interesting.
The offshoot of the Chosen One thing has been a lot of white nerds thinking, this is my story. This is
mine.
And it's nobody else's. Like,
don't touch my thing.
And like, as we kind of branch out from that, people freak out. And it's going to be interesting to see these next several years of pop culture.
I wonder. When you were talking about the prequels for a second, I was thinking how cool it would have been if the prequels actually came first. That would have been much more powerful for me. And then it made me think, in a way, you know, that is what Game of Thrones did.
Oh, yeah.
Game of Thrones presented a chosen one, killed him. Presented another chosen one, killed him. And it makes me wonder if, kind of with how it ended, if it locked itself into this situation where someone was going to have to sit on the throne at the end. You know, and at the end it wasn't an actual throne, but whatever. Someone was going to have to sit on the throne at the end, and that was how the show was going to be judged to some extent, at least by the
painted them in a corner for the throne.
They didn't have to. I think it's kind of what we're saying here. You know, they didn't really have to.
100% agree.
And I think that there was power in the dragon blowing away the throne and maybe having there be no king or queen at the end.
Sure. Yeah, there's a lot of changes we could make as a group to the Game of Thrones finale.
I mean, let's do it. Let's part three.
We got time. So let's 0 to 99 this, shall we?
Yeah.
So, Kenny, in
98 or 99, just incredible movie-going experience.
I think that the movie has grown in my esteem. I think that I said in 99, I gave it an 89.
Wow.
In before sitting down for this podcast, I gave it a 97, and I'd probably say it's a 97 still. An 89 is still really good. I still really loved it in 99.
It is really good. That's true.
But I don't think that I know that I did not understand its brilliance. I didn't really understand the layers to it. So it's only grown in my esteem.
I probably would have been 97 in 1999. Okay. I really loved it.
You knew a lot of stuff when you went in too, which says something.
It made me think about things I didn't want to think about, even beyond trans stuff, you know, even beyond my own identity. It was just like, it made me think a lot about like, oh, I have to question all these rules I grew up with. And like, I don't want to do that right now. So I would have taken 2 points off for that.
Personal discomfort.
Basically. And now I'd be 99.
It's 99.
I think it's pretty close to perfect. Not quite, but pretty close.
Think I would give it a 99, a 99, and a 99. I do. I think that it's like
– it's a fucking great movie.
I don't know. Like, we've done so far that Our Eyes Wide Shut for you. But I think it's the best movie we've done so far. I think it's a perfect studio movie. It's as good as mass pop culture gets.
I agree.
Which I also, I think we discussed this. I also think that's kind of as good as like art gets. I think art for the masses is kind of a pretty high calling.
Mm-hmm.
And
I think it's, I would also say too that it's aged incredibly well.
Incredibly well.
And that's rare.
And I'm also giving it no points for how prescient it is. Like I gave EdTV all these points for how prescient it is, but like, or
the old Matrix EdTV comparison.
Yeah. No, the fact that they were so right about everything means almost nothing to me in the context of this.
I get that
because the movie itself is so powerful, no matter which way the world would have actually gone. So,
you know, I'm very curious to see if they make sequels. You know, I have to say that if they gave it to someone exciting, or if the Wachowskis decided to do more, I'm in, you know, because I think that I'm excited to see what they would do with it now, you know, and what is – so sign me up.
It would be a really great project for a young trans filmmaker. I don't know any though. It would be – no, it really would be a that's the only kind of way to go with it, I think.
I don't disagree.
I couldn't really imagine going any other way. And frankly, there aren't a lot of trans filmmakers who have gotten this kind of shot.
I mean, I think that it seems as though the Wachowskis own it.
Mm-hmm.
It's clear that Warner Brothers would want to go back to that well.
I couldn't imagine them,
but
not them making it without
Warner Brothers. Even if they don't, I don't think Warner Brothers would make it without their blessing.
Yeah.
You know? Well, they wouldn't make it without their blessing for sure. I'm speaking to whether or not they actually would do it themselves, but it's clear to me. I mean, it's clear to everyone that there is there's people talking about a Morpheus prequel, you know, and whether or not there's,
I don't want a prequel,
but if it's about Morpheus and his sort of his fight against, you know, whatever,
they're not that old, right? They're probably late 40s, early 50s.
Who are we talking
about? The Wachowskis.
That's a good question.
Around the age when George Lucas made the prequels. I just wonder if they can be like kind of pulled back in the way he was pulled back in.
I think you got to do it like
early 50s.
I think you got to do it like we all discovered that Split was secretly an Unbreakable sequel.
Yeah.
It's just like – it's a movie about three teenage witches and they're having teenage witches. And at the end, they like meet Lawrence Fishburne
and Morpheus. Yeah.
I mean, that'd be fantastic. So next week, we have the weirdest – not the weirdest, but it's a weird one. Tea with Mussolini.
I love the way you did that. It's a Tea with Mussolini.
We've got a great guest in Barrett Doss, mm-hmm. who plays Vic on Station 19. She was lovely. Kenny and I both went into this thinking basically, what the fuck is this movie? And sat down, the three of us, a little bit sort of unsure as to how this was going to play out. And by the end of it, we all were really on board with Tia Mussolini. We thought it was a lovely film.
Franco Zeffirelli joint.
Franco okay. Zeffirelli. Yeah. Cher, a whole
based
bunch
on
of dames.
His childhood. James Sharon a bunch of dames. That's right.
Sharon a bunch of dames. Dame Judi Dench. Mm-hmm. Dame
Maggie Smith.
As Maggie Smith.
Joan Plowright.
As Mussolini.
Wait, it's Mussolini at different times in his life.
Yes.
Lily Tomlin.
Lily Tomlin, not a dame.
It's a weird movie, guys, but it's a lot of fun. It's a really great episode. I had a blast doing it, and it's so weird
in how not weird it is. It's so weird in how like much it would have been perfectly at home in like this the the 60s, all the 60s movies that we never saw.
Yes.
You know, that absolutely. I know happened, but I just, that just never really like, if that makes any sense.
There's like movies made to get 5 Golden Globe nominations. That's just like old British actors.
Yes.
And then the title is always something ridiculous.
Yes.
Yeah. And that's,
this is ridiculous.
Kind of what this
but
is.
But I don't believe it got any nominations.
No, it did not get any nominations.
And
most of them fail. People didn't
think it was good, but I'll tell you, it's a pretty good movie.
It's a sweet movie. It's got its heart in the right place.
Sweet movie about the Nazi invasion of Italy. Nazis taking over Italy.
Judi Dench yelling at Nazis. You know, like
yeah.
it works in its own weird way.
Matrix, Eyes Wide Shut, EdTV, Tea with Mussolini. Top four.
That's 1994.
We definitely at some point need to hear your top.
Oh yeah.
You have to do it right now. I mean, Lord knows you'll be back.
I could tell you my top four.
Let's hear it.
Easily.
Let's hear it.
Same as mine.
This is from back in the day. Being John Malkovich.
This is having not done any rewatches recently.
Yeah. Being John Malkovich was number one back in the day for me. Absolutely, with a bullet. American Beauty was number two. Toy Story 2 was number three. I love Toy Story 2. Number four was Three Kings. Love
Great
Three
movie.
Kings. I believe that number five was Magnolia.
Okay. So this is your 99 list.
Yeah. This
okay.
is what I sat down in, I think, Spanish class and wrote down my top 10 movies.
Do you know what it would be today?
Malkovich is still number one. Malkovich okay. is one of my favorite movies ever made. Toy Story 2 would still be in my top five. I think Magnolia would still be in my top five. Matrix would be way up there for me now.
You think it might boot Three Kings from the list?
Maybe. I wonder where Three or Kings.
American
I haven't rewatched. Well,
American Beauty is.
American Beauty has really fallen in my esteem. You'll be surprised to find. The Straight Story would be in my top 10. That's one that wasn't in 99.
It's a great movie.
That movie now. So yeah,
it's a great movie. Well, guys, we did The Matrix.
Shit.
It was everything we could have asked for, I think. I mean, it was and great. More. Thank you so much.
Oh, there's one more point I wanted to make.
Okay.
Did you guys notice at the end of the movie?
Yeah.
It says system failure.
Yeah.
And the camera goes right in between the M and the F. System failure. Mm-hmm. And goes in the middle.
Is it? Yeah.
Yes.
What?
That's an identity thing. No?
Oh.
That it ends on the M and the F,
oh, that's
and it sits there, and it goes right in the middle of it.
That's a cool thing. I wonder if that's true.
I'm going to detransition so I can transition again. So I can
about that moment. There you go.
I was sharing. Awesome. Am I wrong?
I didn't put that together. Did you put that together?
I did not. No. I think that's –
it goes right in the middle.
It feels like one of those things that's an accident, like a lot of the trans messaging in this movie. But yeah.
I don't think that was an accident. Like it seemed very – I mean it went right directly into it. Whatever.
I think that's awesome.
All right.
Put that together.
Well, there you go. That's the end of the podcast and the end of the movie.
Thank you all for listening.
All right.
You are still
– find me at TVOTI. I have a trans Twitter account at Sandalwood Emily. You can read my writing on – can I just plug all my shit?
Right now,
of course.
You can read my writing on Vox.com. You can listen to my podcast, Primetime.
Which is fantastic.
The history of television. I have another podcast. It's a fiction podcast called Arden. And you can read my book, Monsters of the Week, The Complete Critical Companion to The X-Files, published under my old name, but – the paperback will be under my actual name, so you can buy
that. That's cool.
Yeah, absolutely. That's awesome.
Thank you so much for coming.
I love being
so
here.
Thank awesome. You so much. This was a really special, amazing episode.
We're totally coming back and bringing Libby for the out-of-towners.
Is that real?
No.
She'll murder all of us.
We're dying to get a guest for the out-of-towners.
We'll all be murdered.
All these fucking garbage movies we have to do. You know, we just did Mickey Blue Eyes. So like,
I have promised. We've all promised her she gets to do a good movie.
Yeah, she's got to do a movie she cares about.
We're running low.
That's not true. Thank you for listening. I'm at PM Iskov on Instagram and Twitter. We are at Podcast Like 1999. Please rate, review, subscribe. Thank you so much for listening.
1999. Podcast like it's just podcast like it. Podcast like it's 1999. Podcast like it. You want a podcast like it? 1999.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices.
Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.